In Beijing, a four-day meeting that promises a, quote, rare resolution on Chinese history. Spoiler alert, it's all about the man at the top. Xi Jinping, elevated to the same rank as Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping, China's other transformative leaders, with an eye to next year and the lifting of de facto term limits. A third term and beyond? Is it one-man rule for the planet's most populous nation? Where does it leave the ruling Communist Party? Whereas Deng's reforms included a transfer of power every decade and a clearer separation between government and party, Xi's model is clearly more Mao. How do ordinary citizens feel about a personality cult that now includes putting the president's thoughts on curriculums as early as elementary school? And how do they feel about the way their leader is steering the country, from flexing its muscle with Taiwan in the South China Sea to a zero-COVID policy that's all but shut the borders since the start of the pandemic? Today in the France 24 debate, we're wondering, is it Xi Almighty that we're witnessing? And with us, political scientist Jean-Louis Roca at the French Political Science Institute Sciences Po, co-author of Class and the Chinese Communist Party, 100 Years of Social Change. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah.
thanks as well to economist Jean-Paul Cheng. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And with us as well, entrepreneur and commentator André Lezecreux-Pitry, president of the Joint European Disruptive Initiative. How are you?
Good evening.
Good evening to you. The France 24 debate on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. Yeah, it's the Chinese Communist Party's Central Committee that's huddling. It's day two of four. State media going full throttle on favorable coverage. Here we see the front page of Monday's edition of the English language newspaper, China Daily, and the Politburo reiterating the line heard in Xi Jinping's July 1st speech to mark the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, in which it says the Chinese nation has ushered in a great leap from standing up, getting rich, to becoming strong and realizing the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, which has entered, it says, an irreversible historical process. André Lezecreux-Pitry, a great leap from standing up, I guess that's Mao, getting rich, I guess that's Deng, and becoming strong, and that must be Xi.
Yeah, it's full-fledged nationalism, obviously used not just in a social and political world, but also in the economic aspect. And probably the turning point was a couple of years ago when there was this China 2025 strategy, which really revealed to the world the new ambitions. Some even say in China that was really the cut towards the more, learning, humble attitude that characterized Deng's time and Deng's legacy.
This changed not so long ago, right?
No, it was. I mean, the first signs were already visible in the sixth plenum, which actually in the 10 years ago, that really prepared Xi's ascension to power because he was already the heir apparent. You could already in some of the speeches see that he had this line, but it was very subtle. It really happened 2014, 2015, that really the assertion, the self-confidence of China was visible to all.
Okay, so that's interesting because the signs were there, says André, when Xi was basically an heir in waiting. He was what was known, I think, as a princeling, right? Because he'd come from a family that was notables inside of the party. Is this planned by a group of people, or is this one man's ascent that we're talking
about? No, I think it's not a one-man system, in fact. We have to precise that the fact that we change of leadership, I would say, every decade is very new in China as well. We are considering that now a sort of tradition, but it's 20 years of tradition, very, very, very recent. And I don't agree with the fact to say, okay, it's like a new Mao Zedong or a new Deng Xiaoping, because they have not the same history, and the Chinese society is not the same as well. Mao were a really powerful guy. He could change, he could say exactly what he wanted to say without asking what the other people, without learning what the other people are thinking about, and Deng Xiaoping really changed really China. Xi Jinping is a very different situation in which he has to take into account the opinions not only of the other people as well, but also of the society, which is a great change. Because now we have a social contract in China, very strong, that the fact that, okay, the CCP is at the top, but the CCP has to provide the population with a lot of things, as we say. For example, a continual increase in the living standards, the opening of opportunities in terms of career, education, etc., and the fact to be proud to be Chinese. Just one example, you can see in the European airport that everything is written in Chinese now. It's a source of proudness for the Chinese. And, you know, the link between politics and society is very linked to that precisely. The fact of, okay, now we have a one-party system. Maybe it's not the best system, but at least this system is providing us with a lot of things, and it's okay for the time being.
Okay, so it's not one-man rule, you're saying. But in that case, why lift term limits?
Because I think, you know, probably the Communist Party is in a very dangerous situation now, you know.
Because dangerous?
Very dangerous to a certain extent. But I think in the year 20, as we say, 2010, 2012, there is a new way of considering, you know, the situation. The fact that, you know, the big danger is to see China, I would say, changing too much in terms of, for example, Chinese enterprises becoming more and more international and then adopting to a certain extent, you know, interests which are not really linked to the Chinese interest. The fact that, as well, you know, the society changed a lot, and a lot of people in the leadership said, okay, we have to said another time that the most important thing for China now is to have a central party, a one-party system. Everything is necessary to be done for the protection and for the interest of that party and for the nation as well. Then that's the reason why we have this new one leader system now, because precisely the leadership decided to have really a new building in terms of the Communist Party and the protection of the Communist Party, because there were fear of being really faced to a very bad situation.
All right, so this concept, do you agree with it, that there's this huge upheaval with the opening of China to the rest of the world? You need to manage the change, so let's keep a safe pair of hands at the top. Is that what it's about, or does she own the Communist Party now?
Partly, yes, of course, because don't forget that we got the world financial crisis in 2007, 2008, and the Chinese government at that time reacted maybe too fast and printed a lot of money and put a huge stimulus package at that time and created a lot of problem after that. So some partisans of Xi Jinping used to think that the 10 years of mandate of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao were 10 wasted years.
Really?
Yeah.
So a wasted 2 decades?
1 decade. 2 mandates of 5 years.
Of Hu Jintao?
Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, because China basically has been opened up and been following mechanically the world trend without too much thinking about the consequences. And suddenly something happened with the crisis, the subprime crisis and the
So what you're saying, crisis. Jean-Paul Chang, is, and we've seen it throughout Chinese history, is there's this strong conservative streak in China.
Let's say Xi Jinping is, I agree that it's a kind of a collective tool to address all this problem left by the president mandates. And actually, he being quite voluntarian in many fields. Among all these fields, which will be probably highlighted by the coming resolution about the party's history. You have to really to count on this anti-corruption campaign, which was actually useful if you want to bring some economic reforms, because you're hurting directly a lot of existing interest group in China. The administration, the party was divided in lot of center of interest. So every reform met obstacle at that time. That's the first point. So Xi Jinping started with anti-corruption. Second thing, he has to address this climate, the green problem. And he did a lot. The third one is the modernization of the Chinese army. He's putting this as priority, and it shows that in 10 years' time, the Chinese army is not recognizable. I mean, changed a lot.
It's changed a lot. André Lézécourt-Pietri, that anti-corruption campaign, when it came to be a decade ago nearly, there were doubters here thinking, is this an anti-corruption campaign or is this a purge within the party of those in opposition to Xi?
Like always in China, there is no one clear answer. It's probably both of it. It was very practical to get rid of some of the factions that were not in favor either of the princelings or of his own. You could also see factions linked to universities. So it was really multifaceted. But not only in China.
You know, we know that anti-corruption is a way as well to get rid of people.
Absolutely.
Even in France, we can give some example of that.
But in China, the obviously it went very far because people literally disappeared from the scope, and I think that's very unique in China. And the second thing is it was used as a way to I think it was mentioned before by you is to change the way the party was remaining relevant for the people.
That's a fascinating point here, because you have what is, I guess, the second recurring verse of party catechism that we've been hearing a lot. This pledge put forth in speeches and in promotional videos, like one we can show you from state broadcasters, CCTV, of a fully, these are the quote, a fully modernized socialist state by 2049. 2049, of course, is the 100th anniversary of the communist takeover in China. And it's fascinating the way China's glory is based on its future more than its past, would you say?
Well, it's difficult to say, but currently, obviously, there's always this bifaceted. You hear always in the official propaganda, each time there is either a criticism or an attack on China, that it relates on the 5,000 years of history. So you always have this word on the history. But then it's definitely a country and a system that is oriented towards the future. And look at the fascination. You're showing pictures about innovation. It's all about innovation and technology. This is the new mantra of this party. And I want to come back to a point that you mentioned before. Is he as strong or less strong than Mao Zedong? For me, Xi is Mao Zedong 2.0. That means Mao plus the power of technology, which allows, for example, one thing, which is to understand real time what actually its population is thinking. And so making this capacity of a social contract extremely efficient for an authoritarian regime, which it is.
It's amazing, this country that is where you have people who are engineers by training, Jean-Louis Roca, and this idea, this sort of technocratic approach to things. We don't really, you know, it's been 10 years for us here in the West. We don't really know who Xi Jinping is.
No, it's a mixture of, I think, of the tradition of leaders, communist leaders, socialist leaders, you know, from 1949, with the connection with precisely the new technocratic system adopted from the West as well. You know, it's very important to say that, you know, the influence of the West from this point of view is very, very important. And it's a connection between, I think, the two in the idea that we, to a certain extent, we can govern the society from the science, not only in terms of engineering and technology, etc., but that the idea, which is very communist to a certain point of view, that we can manage the society from a scientific point of view. And that the reason why, I would just give an example, you know, about inequality. One of the reasons why we have now a very strong system to a certain extent is that, you know, there were a very big increase in terms of inequalities in China from the end of the 90s, very rapid. And precisely the decision made to nominate, as we say, you know, Xi Jinping at the top of the system is precisely because he said, okay, we have now to deal with poverty, to deal with inequality, and to give a chance to every Chinese guy to enter the ranks of the middle class, you know. And the terms of common prosperity is a symbol of that, that the idea, and in the near future, is that every Chinese should be able to enter the ranks of the middle class. This idea is both very communist, socialist, you know, and from this point of view, there is a difference with Mao, because Mao, I know this objective to create a middle class in China. And at the same time, is very, I would say, modern, Western to a certain extent, because I just remember that to create a middle class society was the objective of the Western societies in the 60s, in the 70s, and in the 80s. For the time being, we failed to do that to a certain extent, but it was the objective before.
Just before we go to the break, Jean-Paul Cheng, do we have a better idea today? Do you have a better idea today who Xi Jinping is compared to where we to when he first came to power?
Personally, I believe that he is the man chosen by the party based on the analysis that China is going through a long period of risk and opportunities after the apparent weakening of the West after the financial crisis of 2007-2008. And they anticipated, because they are thinking long-term, the coming hostility, rivalry with the United States. And in this case, they need authoritarian leadership, centralized power to face a lot of problem facing, I mean, to protect the national interest. As everybody knows that the Chinese Communist Party's legacy is the patriotism and the nationalism. So he's the man of the situation.
The man of the situation. We're going to pick up on that point. Stay with us. You're watching the France 24 debate. Welcome back, or welcome if you're just joining us. It's the France 24 debate, and we're asking about China's strongest president since Mao, Xi Jinping, who's huddling with key members of the Communist Party to prepare the lifting of de facto term limits next year. With us to talk about it, political scientist Jean-Marie Roca, co-author of Class and the Chinese Communist Party, 100 Years of Social Change. Economist Jean-Paul Cheng is with us as well, an entrepreneur and commentator, André Lauzicourt-Préthry, president of the Joint European Disruptive Initiative. Now, ahead of this week's four-day plenum, the publication of a six-chapter, 12,000-word official tribute to Xi. It was released by the state news agency Xinhua. It lauds a leader who's defeated a pandemic, bested foreign rivals, and dragged China into the 21st century. And, gosh, you know, you said at the outset, Jean-Louis Roca, that it's not a one-man band. He's doing it with the Communist Party. This is something that's thought out. But boy, the propaganda is fawning for Xi Jinping. Have you learned more about him over these 10 years?
In fact, you know, I think Xi Jinping is from a very specific generation. I think in terms of generation is very interesting, because this guy experienced all the events which happened in the recent history of China. You know, he's born with a He was born with the regime. He was raised with the regime because he was the son of a very important person, you know, in the CCP. And he went to the countryside, you know, in a movement to re-educate, you know, people precisely coming from the leadership. And of course, it was at the core, you know, of the new set of reforms adopted in the 80s and 90s by the Communist Party. And from this point of view, is really the expression of this generation, people who had to change completely of mentality, of personality, of way of doing things, etc., etc. That's the reason why it is very difficult to understand why. If we are to compare, you can imagine somebody from the Middle Age, which ended up in the present time. You know, the fact that these people, you can imagine, you know, were raised a time where capitalism, where, you know, trade was criticized, where every people who are trying to do some money were put in jail, etc., etc. And now, money is very important, wealth is very important, and then, you know, I think it's important to be conscious of that. That's the reason why, you know, you can have at the same time somebody who is precisely going in line with, you know, the socialist time to a certain extent in terms of nationalism, in terms of army, in terms of Taiwan stuff, etc. But also in terms, for example, of managing the society in terms of too much poor people is not, too many poor people is not good, and that we have to redistribute at least a part of the money we accumulated since the beginning of the reform. At the same time, it is somebody which is very involved in terms of technology. He is an engineer, etc., etc. And then he is a mixture of all that, I would say, the history to a certain extent of the socialist China and the Communist Party.
All right, so managing a nation of 1.4 billion, as we were saying in part one of our discussion, with a centralized approach, trying to play the long game, it looks like it's steady, it's solid when you're talking in your party rhetoric about the year 2049. But there's always black swan moments. And all it took 2 weekends ago, for instance, was a single positive case to shut down Disneyland Shanghai for 2 days. 34,000 COVID tests carried out. All of them negative, by the way. This is in a nation that's officially recorded less than 5,000 deaths from COVID since the coronavirus first surfaced in Wuhan. And to be fully up to date, this Tuesday, authorities in this nation of 1.4 billion chalking up a total of 43 COVID cases on the day. Now, this comes at a cost. Really putting a tight lid on COVID, which is you've had fewer people coming in and fewer people coming out of China since March. In fact, the president himself, I don't think, has left the country in 2 years. He didn't show up at the G20. He didn't show up in Glasgow. This approach of zero risk on COVID, could it backfire?
Well, it is backfiring in the international stance of China. And I don't want to contribute or participate in also in this cult of personality that sometimes I can feel from this debate. We need to see that this zero COVID strategy that China has was very successful at the beginning, like other countries done. But given the growing interaction, the fact that there will be the Olympic Games, that there are interaction at the borders, it's probably difficult to hold. Right now, the party has clearly made the choice of privileging the stability beyond the healthcare to the economy. We could, and that results in a lot of impact on energy disruptions, and now globally on the disruption of supply chains, because what's happening right now on a lot of supply chains in the West is a direct consequence of this country where the logistics are not working as well as they used to.
Or is it longer term? Is China becoming more inward looking?
That's maybe the one thing I would not contradict, but I think complement to what Jean-Paul just mentioned on saying it's a lost decade. We should not forget that it's because of the very free almost hyper-capitalist last decade of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, because that's basically what is happening. Everything was possible. There was enrichment, like nobody had an idea, which allows now China to play the lonesome game and to say, okay, now we are rich enough, we are more dependent on our internal market that we can allow ourselves to cut ourselves. And I must say, this strategy of isolation is also very practical, because facing international obligation at the G20 or at Glasgow would be a little bit more complicated for the leader today.
Jean Pecheng, is the zero-risk strategy about the Olympics, because there's a lot of prestige riding on the Games, which are in February, and not having a big COVID outbreak in wintertime there, or, again, is this going to carry all the way through to next year when Xi Jinping is anointed once again as leader?
The zero COVID strategy is not without risk. And now you have experts in China who start to say that it could not be successful because of the Delta variant, because the adaptation of the virus to the human being, etc. So somehow you will see also some impact on the Chinese economy. Disruption in some areas. So I believe that somehow they are going to change a little bit the rule, maybe more tolerant. They announced that they are going to open completely the border with Hong Kong in June already. Partly they relax the rules of quarantine for foreign visitors. And they will probably push for the mutual reconnaissance of vaccines, the Western vaccines against the reconnaissance of the Russian or the Chinese vaccines as well. So a lot of signs will come to, let's say, to change a little bit the radicality of the zero covers, COVID strategy.
And COVID, as we're saying, André, this idea that COVID's maybe not hurt from a health standpoint, the Chinese, yeah, but it has hurt them a lot from a public relations standpoint.
Yeah, public relations, again, I believe that the Chinese philosophy on that is that they are according much more importance for the software vis-à-vis the domestic audience. And vis-à-vis the outside world, they believe in hard power. So they don't care the image of China. They know that people are going to criticize China for everything. So somehow they are judging the facts. The fact is the Chinese growth for the first quarter in 2021 reached 9.8%. Still leading the world, the import export totals increased by 22% in the first 9 months, and foreign.
So all this talk of shorter supply chains, yeah, the West weaning itself off of Chinese goods.
People are disconnecting with the Chinese supply chain, etc. The reality is the foreign direct investment in China increased 25% in the first three quarters of this year. Last year, it reached $144 billion foreign FDI in China, and China was the most attractive in
China. Okay, so Jean-Louis Rocard, it's true that Western capital is investing in China still, and there is foreign direct investment, but what about humans? They're not going to China right now.
Yes, exactly. You know, in fact, there is a China is a very specific period of time. In fact, you know, the idea that we have to rely on domestic demand as a main drive of economic growth is not new. It didn't emerge with Xi Jinping. It was already. I was in China at that time, and I had very interesting discussion with Chinese researchers. The idea that now it's finished. We have to rely on own strengths to a certain extent, and then to depend less on you know the Western you know capital, etc., etc. The problem is that you know this transition is very complicated because we have to sacrifice a lot of things at you know short terms to develop on a long term. That's the reason why we had a very very complex situation in which you know finally China still needs investment from outside, but at the same time they try to concurrence and to develop, you know, products which can be, you know, in direct going directly in concurrence with the Western products. Then, from a certain point of view, they try to close the you know the country, saying okay, we don't need you know Westerners coming to China. At the same time, I'm not sure they are really right on this point, and in certain sectors probably they will continue to need investment and probably humans as well. But for the time being, the idea, and it's clear, for example, people, including Westerners working for university, Chinese university, for them, it's clear if they go back to their home countries, they couldn't go back to China to work, even if they work for Chinese university. The idea is really that we don't need Westerners, but it depends on localities. In some localities, they would like to have investment from outside, and they would like to have coming from. You know that China is not is divided in different localities with very different situation. The economic sectors are very different, you know, from place to place. Then at the same, the situation is very difficult because at the same time they have to, you know, to change of strategy and at the same time keep with that.
Yeah, but you mentioned in part one of our discussion how Xi Jinping is Mao 2.0. If we're talking about a leader for the information age, well, the information age depends on what? The free flow of information. That's how it becomes successful. And we've talked on this show about the misgivings now in the West about the telecoms giant Huawei. In the past, you and I have wondered aloud of where's Jack Ma, because he went AWOL for a while. The founder of Alibaba, who's resurfaced. We found him playing golf at the end of last month in Mallorca, traveling on a yacht, visiting an orchid farm in the Netherlands. China's most famous billionaire did have his wings clipped last year. His blockbuster $37 billion IPO of his fintech affiliate Ant Group was mysteriously and suddenly suspended before he went missing for a long while in action. That, again, that's not a rousing vote of confidence for those who want to do business in China when you have these curveballs that come at you all of a sudden, involving, in fact, the most powerful billionaire in the country. Do we?
Yeah, but China was always this country of the gray zone. So people who wanted easy answers were always mistaken, because there is a little bit of black, a little bit of white, and the vast majority is gray. So that was where a lot of entrepreneurs also played. They always pushed the envelope. You could call it like that. And obviously some went too far. I want to come back to this idea of this scientific approach. And on that one, I must say there's probably some learning also from the West, is what is the world in which we are? It's a world of uncertainty. Nobody knows what's really going to happen. So you need to test a lot of things. And seeing China as a monolith is a big mistake, because there are these local experimentation that Jean-Louis just mentioned. And
hang on, you say just looking at China as a monolith is a big mistake. But that's exactly what the Communist Party wants, isn't it? We just agree that with this top-down approach.
It's probably more subtle than that, because, again, when you think about what social media today allow, they allow real-time taking the pulse of what is important and not and less important for the population. Some call it an authoritarian and rightly so regime, a surveillance regime. But this allows politicians to do what probably in the West we do with polls, but we do very imperfectly. I want to also
On that point.
On that one.
Let me ask you then. Last week, the world was captivated by this story about tennis star Peng Shuye. And she takes to social media to accuse a former vice president of having sex with her against her will, and there's this big move to clean the
Always. I mean, the whole system is built to defend itself. I mean, let's not forget, it's not, and that's why probably also in the West we should less talk about China. We should talk about the Communist Party. That is probably the system competition, because also thanks to this confusion, the Chinese leaders use that also to show that the West is against them. And what happened with Zhang Gaoli, which is this former vice premier that Peng Shuai accused of, I mean, it's a very horrible story that she told. I mean, that went obviously too far, because it's the core of the leadership. Zhang Gaoli is very close to Li Keqiang, so it's not just the inner circle, it's the current leadership which is on the line, and that is obviously a total no-no and a red line.
Jean-Paul Chang, social media, how do the authorities feel about it in this new age?
They are using it for their governance. It shows that they are withdrawing a lot of data to react immediately to meet the need, the claims of the people to maintain their image of serving the people. And the first mission is to make the people happy. Of course, that allows a lot of control also on the other side. But the reality is that social media in China has been accompanying the development of the e-commerce, all the high-tech industries everywhere. You mentioned Jack Ma's IPO, which has been cancelled. It has been interpreted by a lot of even foreign businessmen as a move of regulation in China. They are putting a lot of regulations because Jack Ma
lost more than $300 billion in value at Alibaba.
Yeah, because the Ant Group was involved in the financial business and want to avoid the supervision of the Supervisory Commission of Banking and Insurance Company. So somehow it's the coming back of the regulation in China. And we saw the same thing in other countries, and maybe it's
right,
coming.
So that's priming the pump for another discussion on what's next. I want to thank you so much, Jean-Paul Chang. Unfortunately, we're running short on time. I want to thank André Lezicuc-Pietri, Jean-Louis Roca. Thank you for joining us here in the France 24 debate.